as a female pioneer in the tech business. She sat for an endless series of treacly media profiles, including a spread in the fashion magazine Vogue. In the end, her tenure was a measurable disaster. Yahoo's core search business was sold to Verizon for less than $5 billion. That's a $95 billion discount from what it was once worth. Yet somehow, in return for presiding over Yahoo's destruction, Mayer became richer than ever. She collected a total of $239 million in compensation from the company. That's $900,000 for every week she spent destroying it. In an earlier age, this would be known as looting. The popular press would have attacked Marissa Mayer as a living symbol of incompetence and greed. Angry workers might have picketed her house. That's not what happened. Liberals celebrated Mayer as a next-generation feminist hero. She currently serves on the board of Walmart. Identity politics protected Mayer. As a progressive member of a protected group, her threshold for failure was adjusted radically upward. But that's not the only reason Mayer dodged the criticism she deserved. Liberals don't scrutinize power like they used to, probably because they now wield it. Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook is richer than Andrew Carnegie ever was, but he never worked in a cotton mill. Zuckerberg grew up in an affluent New York suburb, the son of a dentist and a psychiatrist, and attended both Exeter and Harvard. From birth to the present day, Zuckerberg has never lived outside the elite culture that produced him. Fortunately for him, neither have many of his coworkers, or for that matter, many of the reporters who cover him, or the lawmakers charged with regulating him. They're all from the same world. Starting in college, Zuckerberg has been repeatedly accused of unethical business practices. Evidence has mounted that Facebook is an addictive product that harms users, and that Zuckerberg knew that from the beginning, but kept selling it to the unknowing consumers. Those facts would have been enough to tarnish most reputations, if not spark congressional hearings, yet Zuckerberg remains a celebrated national icon. The only people who could punish Zuckerberg are his peers, and they don't seem to notice or care. Zuckerberg started his first web venture in 2003 while a student at Harvard. The site was called FaceMash. It compiled photos of Harvard students and allowed visitors to evaluate their attractiveness. Zuckerberg published the photos without students' permission. School administrators scolded him, but let him stay at Harvard and build more websites. Inspired by Harvard's printed student directory, Facebooks, Zuckerberg and friends decided to create their own version online. Initially available only on campus, Facebook proved immensely popular and expanded to other elite colleges, then to all colleges, then to high school students, and finally to everyone, 13 and older. As Facebook grew, several of Zuckerberg's early collaborators accused him of stealing credit and shares in the company. Lawsuits followed and Zuckerberg paid. But Facebook kept growing. The company now has close to 2 billion users worldwide. Zuckerberg is worth more than $70 billion. From the beginning, Zuckerberg displayed contempt for his customers, even as he reveled in the power the company gave him. Just days before Facebook's launch, Zuckerberg bragged to a friend online about how he held the personal information of virtually every student on campus and offered, quote, info about anyone at Harvard. They trust me, Zuckerberg explained. Dumb fucks. Several years later, Zuckerberg assured users that they shouldn't worry about Facebook's power over them or be concerned about their lost privacy. As Zuckerberg explained, the social norm of privacy itself no longer existed. People no longer had any right to worry about strangers snooping on them. Zuckerberg maintained a different standard for himself. One of the first things he did with his Facebook wealth was buy a secluded 750-acre estate in Hawaii and then surround it with a 6-foot wall. To create a privacy buffer around his house in Palo Alto, Zuckerberg bought 4 adjacent properties for a total of more than $30 million. Pictures show that Zuckerberg covers the webcam on his personal laptop with masking tape. For privacy reasons, Mark Zuckerberg doesn't trust tech companies. Meanwhile, Facebook continues to gather ever-growing amounts of intimate information about its customers. Most users understand that Facebook can see everything in a given profile, photos, likes, friends. But Facebook's surveillance goes much deeper. Most people have no idea. Use Facebook's mobile app on your phone? Facebook sees and records everywhere you go. Facebook knows the stores you visited, the events you attended, whether you walked, drove, or rode your bike. Because Facebook is integrated onto so many other sites, the company also knows much of your web browsing history as well, even when you're not browsing on Facebook. By synthesizing this information, Facebook's algorithms can make astonishingly accurate assumptions about your life. After tracking where you live and what you buy online, Facebook can deduce your assets, even if you've never posted a single word on Facebook about money. Facebook's facial recognition software is now so advanced, it can detect users in uploaded photos even if the users haven't been tagged. This level of knowledge is what makes Facebook so valuable. Facebook knows more about its users than many spouses know about each other. Facebook sells this information to companies which use it to make the most finely tuned advertising pitches in history. In effect, Facebook's customers are its product, the commodity it offers for sale. The company's success is based on how much time it can get users to spend staring at a screen, providing eyeballs for ads and data for the company's algorithms. The company has been remarkably successful at winning and keeping users. In the United States and Canada, 184 million people use Facebook or its affiliated apps every day, for an average of about 50 minutes each. For many people, Facebook functions like an addiction. There's a reason for that. In the fall of 2017, Facebook's first president, Sean Parker, gave an interview to Axios in which he admitted that Facebook can override the free will of its users. The product is literally addictive. It was engineered to be that way. When engineers design Facebook, Parker explained, they ask themselves, how do we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible? In order to achieve that, he said, we need to sort of give you a little dopamine hit every once in a while because someone liked or commented on a photo or post or whatever. And that's going to get you to contribute more content. And that's going to get you more likes and comments. Parker wasn't exaggerating. A study published in 2016 found that using Facebook stimulated the brain in a way similar to cocaine. Ramsey Brown, co-founder of a firm called Dopamine Labs, which uses neuroscience to make apps more compelling, explained to a Bay Area television station that Facebook and its subsidiary Instagram use precise algorithms to time notifications and alerts to give users a maximally addictive dopamine hit. Quote, sometimes there's nothing waiting for you. Sometimes there's a friend request or someone wrote on your wall, Brown said. Sometimes there's just kind of like filler crap. It's not pertinent to your life, but Facebook's algorithms have figured out that showing it to you then is going to be slightly more surprising than not showing it to you at all or showing it to you later. In his Axios interview, Parker noted that Facebook wasn't just as addictive as a drug, but was having similarly wide-reaching effects. Quote, Facebook literally changes your relationship with society, with each other, he said. God only knows what it's doing to our children's brains. It was a stunning omission, but it received surprisingly little attention at the time. Tobacco companies spent decades making their products more addictive, but hid that fact because they feared punishment and increased government oversight. Parker had no such fears. Indeed, Parker boasted about how rich he'd become selling an addictive product. Because I'm a billionaire, he said, I'm going to have access to better health care, so I'm going to be like 160. I'm going to be part of this, like, class of immortal overlords. Parker wasn't the only Facebook executive to admit the company had a destructive effect on its customers. In December of 2017, a former Facebook vice president conceded the company had gravely injured humanity itself, quote, I think we have created tools that are ripping apart the social fabric of how society works, he said. Science agrees. A 2017 study in the American Journal of Epidemiology found that the use of Facebook correlated with declining psychological and even physical health. The more time people spent liking posts or updating their Facebook status, the less happy they felt. Plenty of other research discovered the same thing. One study from 2014 found heavy Facebook use was associated with eating disorders. A 2015 University of Missouri study found that Facebook made people depressed and envious from viewing the carefully curated lives of their friends. In 2016, a study found that quitting Facebook improved psychological health. Facebook's photo-sharing site Instagram may be even worse for human well-being. A 2017 survey by the British Royal Society for Public Health found that Instagram was the most harmful of all the major social networks. Use of the app caused loneliness, anxiety over body image, and other maladies. Facebook knows all this. It uses the knowledge to boost revenue. A leaked internal document published in The Australian in 2017 noted that Facebook's internal algorithms could deduce the emotional states of users based on their behavior on the website. The company uses the information to direct ad campaigns. Some of the emotional states the company claimed it could detect included worthless, defeated, stupid, useless, insecure, and failure. Facebook is omnipresent. It is addictive, intentionally so. Its product hurts people, including children. What have America's elites done about it? Nothing. Congress has never held a hearing on social media addiction or how it's harming society. No lawmakers are even considering legislation to address any of this. Reporters couldn't be less interested. When the media do cover Mark Zuckerberg, it's usually in an adulatory way. The Wall Street Journal once published a piece suggesting the country needs more of him. Quote, how to raise the next Mark Zuckerberg. Harvard President Drew Faust went even further. Mark Zuckerberg's leadership has profoundly altered the nature of social engagement worldwide, Faust slobbered, as she introduced Zuckerberg as Harvard's 2017 commencement speaker. And few individuals can rival Mark Zuckerberg in his drive to change our world through the innovative use of technology, as well as his commitment to advance science, enhance education, and expand opportunity through the pursuit of philanthropy. Zuckerberg seems to agree with this characterization. On his own Facebook page, Zuckerberg describes his personal mission this way, quote, I'm trying to make the world a more open place. There's no mention of ripping apart the social fabric. Tobacco companies once tried marketing like this. More doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. The difference is the media called them on it. A glowing cover story in Time magazine from 2014 opens with a photo of Zuckerberg surrounded by a crowd of poor children in India. Our mission is to connect every person in the world, Zuckerberg is quoted as saying. The article does briefly note the obvious financial interest Facebook has in hooking every living person on social media. But the piece quickly moves on to suggest that, quote, creating wealth and saving lives are likely Zuckerberg's real motives. When elites do focus their attention on Facebook, it's invariably to demand the company exert even more control over its users. Following the 2016 election, there were widespread calls for Facebook to further restrict the news Americans are allowed to see on the site. According to the Washington Post, Barack Obama took Zuckerberg aside during a meeting of world leaders in Peru and begged him to impose greater censorship. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California made the same demand, quote, you created these platforms and now they are being misused, she said, and you have to be the ones who do something about it, or we will. If only Obama and Feinstein were as concerned about Facebook's relentless invasions of the public's privacy, or about the millions of addicted users steadily degrading from its use, or about the rending of the social fabric. Perhaps in order to inoculate himself against elite criticism, Zuckerberg has immersed himself in fashionable political causes. In 2013, he launched a nonprofit called FWD.US to advocate for mass immigration. The group lobbied against immigration enforcement and pushed for amnesty for more than 11 million illegal immigrants in the United States, complete with citizenship and voting rights. Some of this lobbying took place in the open in the form of op-eds and meetings on Capitol Hill. Some was more devious. In 2013, FWD.US created a satellite organization called Americans for a Conservative Direction. Its purpose was to cast support for more immigration as a conservative position. One of the group's ads was so stealthy it didn't even mention immigration. Instead, it promoted the Keystone XL pipeline, trashed Obamacare, and derided Washington's, quote, Chicago-style politics. These ads ran on behalf of Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. The point was to paint Graham as a reliable conservative in order to give him sufficient cover with voters to support amnesty. At the same time, FWD.US created another satellite group, this one called the Council for American Job Growth. That group attacked Republicans and framed immigration reform as a progressive cause. When caught playing both sides against voters, FWD.US was blunt about its strategy, quote, maintaining two separate entities to support elected officials across the political spectrum, the group explained, means that we can more effectively communicate with targeted audiences of their constituents. In other words, whatever it takes. By the 2016 election, Facebook itself was producing propaganda from its headquarters in Menlo Park. Former employees told Gizmodo they routinely suppressed right-leaning stories on the company's breaking news platform. News curators kept stories they regarded as conservative from appearing among those trending on Facebook, even if actual share numbers indicated they were popular enough to be included. In one case, Facebook suppressed critical stories about Lois Lerner, the IRS official who blocked conservative groups seeking nonprofit status. Facebook also spiked positive stories about Ted Cruz, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, and Chris Kyle, the murdered Navy SEAL who was the subject of the film American Sniper. One conservative group found itself banned from Facebook for saying that Donald Trump did not hate Muslims. At the same time, Facebook employees artificially promoted stories they agreed with. In one case, the company boosted coverage of the Black Lives Matter movement, even though it wasn't trending among actual Facebook users. The cause was popular enough inside the building. Zuckerberg himself endorsed Black Lives Matter in an internal message to staff. In the same memo, he condemned an employee unwise enough to write "All Lives Matter" on a company bulletin board. For someone committed to increasing global openness, Zuckerberg has been consistently willing to abet censorship in authoritarian regimes abroad. In just 6 months in 2015, Facebook blocked 55,000 pieces of politically sensitive content in 20 different countries at the request of foreign governments. In February 2018, Instagram caved to Russia's demands and censored a video by one of the most prominent anti-Putin opposition leaders. Above all, Facebook has proved eager to accommodate the demands of the Chinese government. Facebook has been blocked in China since 2009, after the site was used by pro-independence activists in the region of Xinjiang, and has been working to get back in ever since. In 2016, Facebook reportedly developed a tool that would allow it to suppress posts from appearing in news feeds within certain geographic areas, presumably of the direction of Chinese government censors. So far, it hasn't been enough. Facebook still hasn't broken into China. When it does, expect Zuckerberg's many fans in the media and Congress to applaud uncritically. Bill and Hillary Clinton will doubtless send a congratulatory text, all of which is a measure of how much American society has changed over a relatively short period. There was a time when Bill and Hillary Clinton would have been deeply suspicious of Facebook and its appeasement of authoritarian regimes. The Clintons entered American politics during a period when educated young people tended to consider themselves civil libertarians and enemies of the establishment. Bill and Hillary were Nixon haters and supporters of the radical George McGovern campaign. Bill helped organize protests against Lyndon Johnson's war in Vietnam. Hillary's first major speech to the graduating class at Wellesley College in 1969 was a broadside aimed at her school's own commencement speaker, establishment Republican Senator Edward Brooke. Hillary criticized Brooke for advocating for gradual social change rather than revolutionary protest. The Clintons no longer have those views, to put it mildly, and not just because they're older. After decades in power, Bill and Hillary have become arch defenders of the status quo, political and economic. Hillary's 2016 presidential run resembled nothing so much as a counterinsurgency campaign designed to beat back challenges to existing authority, specifically herself. She collaborated with party bosses to undercut her primary opponent, Bernie Sanders, who posed a threat precisely because he was more popular with the party's younger idealistic voters. It was a cynical effort by a cynical establishment politician to retain power at any cost. In one of the great ironies of American politics, it was Hillary's cynicism that undid her campaign. Warned by advisors that she needed to address middle-class economic frustration, Hillary refused. She found populist economics distasteful and, more than that, unnecessary. Voters, she assumed, would believe what they're told. So the Clinton campaign soldiered on with its original message. Things in America are fine. It's Hillary's turn to be president. You'd have to be a bigot to oppose her. No aging potentate was ever more out of touch. Not surprisingly, Hillary's only child is even more removed from the people she claims to advocate for. Unlike her mother, Chelsea Clinton never made the journey from rebellious young person to establishment elder. She began and stayed in the establishment. She's the living embodiment of the modern American ruling class. Born in 1980 while her father was governor of Arkansas, Chelsea Clinton's life parallels the rise of our meritocratic elite. By 12, she was living in the White House and enrolled at Sidwell Friends School, where the children of presidents, cabinet secretaries, and Washington journalists have gone for decades. From Sidwell, Chelsea chose Stanford from a long list of schools eager to have her, including Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Brown. In news stories at the time, Harvard scrambled to reassure other applicants that Chelsea, quote, didn't have to play the daddy card and was admitted entirely based on her own grades and test scores. Coincidentally, all four of then-Vice President Al Gore's children were also admitted to Harvard, presumably also on the strength of their grades and test scores. After finishing at Stanford, Chelsea won admission to Oxford, where she received a master's degree in international relations. The head of University College at Oxford noted that, quote, the college is also pleased to extend its link with the Clinton family. Soon after graduation, Chelsea won one of the most prestigious jobs in the world at the management consulting firm McKinsey & Company. She was the youngest member of her consultant class. Despite having no experience in finance, business, or for that matter, employment, Chelsea received the same rank as classmates who had completed MBAs. At 23, she was making $120,000 a year. She didn't stay long. 3 years later, at just 26, Chelsea moved to a job as a chemical industry analyst with Avenue Capital Group, a $12 billion hedge fund. Her salary at the firm wasn't public, but it would have been generous. The fund was run by longtime Clinton donor Mark Lazary. Looking back in a 2014 interview with Fast Company, Chelsea downplayed the financial benefits of all this. She described her early jobs as a process of self-discovery, a kind of metaphysical experiment that allowed her to shed materialism and ascend above the sad wage chasers around her. I was curious if I could care about money on some fundamental level, and I couldn't, she said. That wasn't the metric of success that I wanted in my life. To signify her commitment to a simpler existence, Chelsea and her husband bought a 5,000-square-foot, $10 million apartment in New York City's Flatiron District. The unit was reported to be the widest apartment in New York. It stretched an entire city block. Despite her emphatic rejection of materialism, Chelsea somehow got rich during President Obama's two terms. In 2011, she was hired as a special correspondent by NBC. To some, this seems surprising since Chelsea had never worked in television or as a journalist anywhere. Indeed, she had no relevant experience at all. NBC didn't mind. The company paid Chelsea $600,000 a year, far more than other entry-level correspondents. At the time, Chelsea's mother was known to be planning a presidential run and was considered likely to win. Chelsea's spokesperson described the NBC job as an opportunity, quote, to serve in the public good. Chelsea worked at NBC for just under 3 years. It's debatable how much public good she achieved. She did very few stories. In one segment, Chelsea flew to Kenya to visit an elephant orphanage. In another, she interviewed participants in the foster grandparent program. In one memorable exchange, Chelsea interviewed the animated gecko character from Geico insurance commercials. She asked the character whether he was recognized on the street. By the time she quit to advise her mother's presidential campaign, Business Insider calculated that Chelsea had appeared on network television for a total of just 58 minutes, less than 4 seconds a day. NBC paid her $26,724 for every minute she spent on the air. But television reporting wasn't Chelsea's only source of income. In 2011, while still a student at Oxford, she joined the board of IAC Interactive Corp., the media conglomerate. The position paid her $50,000 a year, roughly the annual income of the average American household, plus $250,000 per year in company stock. In a statement, IAC boasted that Chelsea's, quote, skills and background complement the existing areas of expertise of other board members. There was no mention of what those specific skills might be. There seemed to be consensus that Chelsea was among the most talented and deserving people in the world. It's also true that the chairman of IAC's board was Barry Diller, a longtime Clinton family donor and friend. Whatever Chelsea did on the IAC board must have been impressive, because in the spring of 2017, Diller handed her another board seat, this one at the travel company Expedia, where he is also chairman. The seat was created for her. It paid $45,000 a year, plus an annual $250,000 in stock. Not bad for someone who rejects the principle of money. Apparently, good things come to those who don't seek them. Deepak's law of detachment in action. and the money kept flowing. Chelsea began a highly lucrative sideline giving speeches. In 2015, the University of Missouri at Kansas City balked at paying Hillary Clinton's $275,000 speaking fee. Instead, the school paid Chelsea $65,000 for a brief appearance on campus. Other speeches followed. By this point, Chelsea was busier than ever. She got a producing credit on a film about interfaith friendship. Most significantly, she became vice chair of the Clinton Foundation, her family's vast nonprofit. Officially a charity, the foundation had commercial uses as well. In emails leaked during the 2016 election, former Clinton aide Doug Band complained that Chelsea and her husband, Mark Mezvinsky, used the Clinton Foundation to solicit investments for Eagle Vale Partners, Mezvinsky's hedge fund. Unlike his wife, Mezvinsky never struggled to make himself care about money. Mezvinsky did, however, struggle to earn money. Eagle Vale Partners attracted several $100 million in investments, including sizable sums from various Clinton donors. Mezvinsky used some of that cash to make huge bets on the future of the Greek economy. That turned out to be unwise. By early 2016, Mezvinsky's Hellenic Opportunity Fund had lost 90% of its value. Just 1 month after Hillary Clinton's 2016 defeat, the entire hedge fund went under. Investors wanted their money back. In the wake of his mother-in-law's loss, Mezvinsky's financial acumen was considered diminished. Throughout Chelsea's years in the public eye, there have been rare critics who sniped that she's the beneficiary of cronyism and nepotism. Some accused her of playing through life on the lowest difficulty setting without even realizing it. The media were not among those critics. They celebrated Chelsea as the stunningly accomplished woman they consider her to be. A 2013 profile in Parade magazine is typical, quote, "Clinton's concentration does not waver. She demonstrates a masterly command of the issues and swiftly zeroes in on crucial questions. Statistics roll comfortably off her tongue. Praise comes as quickly as critical suggestions. Wonky words like metrics and cohort fit naturally into her carefully constructed sentences." If you've graduated from high school, you might not consider words like metric and cohort advanced vocabulary. Editors of the New York Times disagree. The paper celebrated Chelsea for using the terms anathema and behemoth. The site Refinery 29 congratulated her for refracted. In 2014, Fast Company praised Chelsea as not only a fluent English speaker, but also a visionary innovator. Quote, "Chelsea is as forward-thinking and open-minded as any Silicon Valley entrepreneur of her generation." Given all this, it wasn't surprising when Glamour magazine honored Chelsea with one of its 2014 Women of the Year awards. The prize was awarded for Chelsea's important work at the Clinton Foundation, though the magazine wasn't specific about what that might be. There was no mention of fundraising for her husband's hedge fund. In the months after the 2016 election, Chelsea didn't hide or retreat from public life. Forward-thinking entrepreneurs don't do that. Instead, she wrote a socially aware children's book, She Persisted, which she promoted on a 12-city tour. The publisher described the book as aimed at, quote, "tiny feminists, mini activists, and little kids who are ready to take on the world." It's unclear how many children read it. By the age of 36, Chelsea had been a scholar at Oxford, a top management consultant, a hedge fund whiz, a corporate director, a network television correspondent, a nonprofit executive, a published author, a documentary filmmaker, and a senior advisor to a presidential campaign. Short of winning a Victoria Cross for gallantry, there wasn't much left for her to achieve, so she became a public intellectual. Twitter was Chelsea's canvas. The New York Times heralded her arrival with a story of more than 1,000 words. "Now on Twitter, Chelsea Clinton, unbound!" The paper described her as sarcastic and feisty, its highest possible praise. CNN enthusiastically concurred. "Free from the constraints of her mother's political ambitions," the story said, "Chelsea is taken to the medium, posting frequently and weighing in on current events with a distinctive, sometimes sassy voice America hasn't heard before." At BuzzFeed, celebrity editor Lauren Yapalater swooned with excitement. "Recently, Chelsea has been addressing everything in our country right now with tweets that are both subtly shady and also just blunt," she wrote. "Chelsea's tweets are soul-cleansing." Ordinary Twitter readers might be forgiven for having a different reaction. Most of Chelsea's tweets were indistinguishable from the familiar brand of easily offended Acela-class elitism. Some were aggressively banal. One read this way, "Words without action are meaningless. Words with inaction are just words. Words with opposite action is hypocrisy." In another, she reported this, "Yesterday I saw a man in jeans and a t-shirt riding a skateboard. It was 28 degrees. Thankfully, he was also wearing a helmet." Sassy, soul-cleansing. But Chelsea could also be stern when necessary, especially when fellow Twitter users needed to be reminded of the rules. In March 2017, a jewelry company ran a billboard ad joking, "Sometimes it's okay to throw rocks at girls," meaning diamonds. Chelsea's response? "Talking about hitting girls is never funny. Ever." In the early months of the Trump administration, White House aide Steve Bannon was asked about the low number of televised briefings. Bannon joked that Press Secretary Sean Spicer had, quote, "got fatter." Chelsea swung into action. "The White House using fat shaming to justify increased opacity, 2017, Clinton tweeted. When another Twitter user pointed out that Bannon was joking, Chelsea summoned her signature sassiness. "Oh, okay," she wrote. "So using fat shaming to avoid answering questions about increasing opacity. Got it. 2017. The New York Times treated exchanges like this like the discovery of an unpublished Proust novel. The paper ran a feature on Chelsea's reading habits and book recommendations. Elle published a celebratory piece, "Chelsea Clinton on the Obama Girls, Overcoming Discouragement and How We Must Empower Young Girls." Variety put Chelsea on its cover and interviewed her about her expertise in social media. Questions included, "Where does your empowerment come from?" Also, "What were your favorite foods growing up?" Chelsea's response revealed a lot about what her childhood must have been like. "I liked healthy food because those were really the only foods they let me eat," she said. By late 2017, Chelsea was back in the pages of Teen Vogue. There she published an open letter to her children, which may or may not have begun as a late-night Facebook screed, and in any case didn't sound like the kind of thing you'd write to your kids or that they would voluntarily read. Teen Vogue proudly ran it anyway. In her letter, Chelsea complained about Donald Trump, came out against bullying and climate change, and fretted that transgender soldiers were no longer welcome in the military. She ended by noting that, quote, "protecting children isn't someone else's job, it's all our jobs, even if the president doesn't think it's his." It was nothing readers hadn't seen before. What's interesting is what Chelsea didn't say. She didn't challenge the existing order or even acknowledge its existence. She didn't wonder why an ever-shrinking number of Americans control an ever-expanding share of the country's wealth. She didn't ask why the middle class is dying or why our society is fragmenting. She definitely didn't pause to consider how someone so thoroughly ordinary as herself could become rich and famous in a country that claims to promote on the basis of achievement. If the meritocracy is real, why is Teen Vogue pretending a letter so stupefyingly conventional is brilliant? That would have been a good question. Chelsea didn't ask. She's not interested in the answer. She has no idea she should be. In Chelsea Clinton's world, nobody tells her she's wrong. Chapter 2. Importing a Surf Class. In an earlier age, American leaders never dismissed the country's population as lazy and immoral. They might have said so privately in restaurant booths or on golf courses, and surely they did, but never in public. That would have seemed snobbish and out of touch, even anti-American. Vilifying the middle class in a middle-class country was unpatriotic. 50 years ago, elites understood that the point of any major government policy was to help as many Americans as possible. They often fell short of that standard, but they never challenged it. Their political heroes reflected their priorities. Most of the people they revered, even the ideologues on the hard left, were effectively populists, leaders whose main concern was the dignity and prosperity of average people. In the American West, no populist figure was more revered than Cesar Chavez. Chavez, an itinerant farm worker with a seventh grade education, founded and led the United Farm Workers Union. In the 1960s, Chavez led the legendary Delano Grape Strike, which lasted for 5 years and inspired college students across the country to wear boycott grapes pins. Chavez's signature rallying cry, "Si se puede," yes we can, became so famous among well-educated liberals that Barack Obama used it as a campaign slogan when he ran for president. Growing up in California, I can't remember a year when we didn't celebrate the life and achievements of Cesar Chavez in class. Chavez's name is still everywhere in the state. There are 6 libraries, 11 parks, half a dozen major roads, at least 25 public schools named in California after him, more than George Washington. That doesn't include the many Cesar Chavez academic buildings, student centers, and at least one college. Cesar Chavez Day is a California state holiday. Most enduring is Chavez's Si Se Puede. Whenever left-wing demonstrators gather, you will hear it. It's most common at pro-immigration rallies. Several times I've seen illegal aliens scream it while carrying Mexican flags. Every time I say a silent prayer of thanks that Cesar Chavez is long dead. It would have been torture for him. Cesar Chavez didn't support illegal aliens. Chavez didn't like immigration at all, generally, especially the low-skilled kind. Chavez understood that new arrivals from poor countries will always work for less than Americans. Immigration hurt the members of his union, undercutting their wages and weakening their leverage in negotiations with management. Cesar Chavez believed in vigilantly defended borders. When government refused to protect them, Chavez did it himself. In the early 1960s, Chavez fought the federal Bracero program, which gave farmers permission to import hundreds of thousands of seasonal workers from Mexico to pick crops. Growers loved the program because it lowered their labor costs. Chavez hated it for the same reason. Congress killed the Bracero program in 1964, after which Chavez turned his sights on illegal aliens, or as he called them, wetbacks. In 1969, Chavez led a march down the agricultural spine of California to protest the hiring of illegal workers by growers. Marching alongside him were future presidential candidate Walter Mondale and the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, longtime aide to Martin Luther King. By 1972, the problem of illegal labor streaming over the border had worsened. In an interview with a San Francisco television station, Chavez railed against the, quote, wetbacks and illegal immigrants from Mexico who were threatening his workers. As he said, as long as we have a poor country bordering California, it's going to be very difficult to win strikes. When the U.S. government failed to secure the border, Chavez's unionized fruit pickers acted unilaterally. In the winter of 1979, UFW members, almost all of them Hispanic, began intercepting Mexican nationals as they crossed the border and assaulted them in the desert. Their tactics were brutal. Chavez's men beat the immigrants with chains, clubs, and whips made of barbed wire. Illegal aliens who dared work as scabs had their houses bombed and their cars burned. The union paid Mexican officials to keep quiet. In an interview with the New York Times, Yuma County Sheriff Travis Yancey recalled watching as the UFW men set up what they called a wet line, 100 miles of military tents along the Arizona-Mexico border. Quote, each tent was manned by 5 or 6 of their people who were paid $5 to $7 a day plus their grub, said Yancey. They'd catch any wet coming through and beat the hell out of them. Chavez didn't deny any of this. Yes, there was a union wet line along the border, he said. It cost us a lot of money and we stopped a lot of illegals. At one union meeting, which was tape recorded, a UFW official confronted Chavez about using the terms illegals and wetbacks. Chavez responded angrily. No, a spade's a spade, he said. You guys get these hang-ups. God damn it, how do we build a union? They're wets, you know, they're wets, and let's go after them. Chavez was blunter than most, but his views weren't unusual in the American labor movement. Union leaders had opposed mass immigration since the 1860s. The Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which banned the immigration of Chinese laborers, is often cited as an example of race hatred and xenophobia, and it may have been. But fundamentally, it was a form of protectionism. The Knights of Labor backed it, and when the law came up for reauthorization in 1901, so did the American Federation of Labor. Thanks to lobbying from unions, the Chinese Exclusion Act remained the law for more than 60 years. Many similar laws followed. In 1885, Congress passed a measure that forbade companies from hiring foreign contract workers. 2 years later, the government tightened vetting of immigrants at ports of entry. In 1888, Congress mandated fines for companies that hired illegals. All of these bills were backed by organized labor. In 1917, the American Federation of Labor successfully pushed for literacy tests for foreign workers, which had the fully intended effect of restricting immigration from Eastern and Southern European countries. Samuel Gompers, the famed AFL leader who was himself an immigrant, explained that, quote, immigration is working a great injury to the people of our country. For most of the 20th century, organized labor remained skeptical of immigration. In the 1950s, the AFL merged with the Congress of Industrial Organizations, creating the modern AFL-CIO. After the merger, the union adopted a position friendly to modest legal immigration, but remained sharply opposed to illegal immigration, which it rightly saw as a vehicle for both suppressing wages and undermining organized labor. Throughout this era, organized labor was firmly aligned with the Democratic Party, and Democrats in turn took positions on immigration that at least acknowledged the concerns of American wage earners. Democrats opposed illegal immigration and worried about the consequences of legal immigration. They believed assimilation was important. In 1975, Governor Jerry Brown of California opposed the admission of hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese boat people after the fall of Saigon. Julia Taft ran the resettlement effort for the Ford administration. In an interview with NPR decades later, Taft recalled the pushback she received from Brown, famous at the time as one of America's most liberal politicians. Brown, Taft said, quote, didn't want any of these refugees because California had unemployment. They already had a large number of foreign-born people there. They said they had too many Hispanics, too many people on welfare. They didn't want these people. Jerry Brown said pretty much the same thing himself to the Los Angeles Times. Quote, there is something a little strange about saying, let's bring in 500,000 more people when we can't take care of the 1 million Californians out of work. For Brown, the obligation to citizens already in California came first. Senator Joe Biden of Delaware agreed. He introduced legislation to curb the arrival of Vietnamese immigrants, accusing the Ford administration of not being honest about how many refugees would be arriving. Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia was even more direct. Exactly 1 week after the last helicopter lifted off from the roof of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, Byrd demanded extreme vetting of Vietnamese refugees in order to cull what he called the barmaids, prostitutes, and criminals. Even George McGovern, the Democratic nominee who lost 49 states to Richard Nixon, opposed opening the gates. I think the Vietnamese are better off in Vietnam, he said. This attitude was once conventional in the Democratic Party. Nobody doubted that an influx of refugees would harm American workers. One study, conducted after the Mariel boat lift of 1980, found that Americans with lower education levels in Miami saw their wages fall by 37% after the Cuban refugees arrived. Modern Democrats wax enthusiastic about the virtues of economic competition, but that's an idea they borrowed fairly recently from libertarians. Nobody on the left was saying that at the time. Here's how one prominent Democrat described his position on immigration in 1995. Quote, all Americans, not only in the states most heavily affected, but in every place in this country, are rightly disturbed by the large numbers of illegal aliens entering our country. The jobs they hold might otherwise be held by U.S. citizens or immigrants. The public services they use impose burdens on our taxpayers. The speaker? President Bill Clinton, addressing Congress in his State of the Union speech. Pat Buchanan never put it more succinctly. Clinton went on to boast about hiring more Border Patrol officers, cutting off welfare for illegal immigrants, and cracking down on employers who hired illegal workers. He called for speedier deportations of illegal immigrants. Quote, it is wrong and ultimately self-defeating for a nation of immigrants to permit the kind of abuse of our immigration laws that we've seen in recent years, Clinton said. We must do more to stop it. He got a standing ovation. At one point in his speech, Clinton cited Barbara Jordan, the civil rights figure and former congresswoman from Texas, who was then the chair of the U.S. Commission on Immigration Reform. Jordan was an enthusiastic Democrat. She gave the opening speech at Richard Nixon's impeachment hearings. Nobody confused Barbara Jordan with a right-winger. At the time, a restrictionist position on immigration wasn't considered incompatible with liberalism. In 1994, Jordan noted that it is, quote, both a right and a responsibility of a democratic society to manage immigration so that it serves the national interest. The next year, she launched a broadside against multiculturalism in the pages of the New York Times, quote, those who choose to come here must embrace the common core of American civic culture, she wrote. We must assist them in learning our common language, American English. Jordan didn't oppose all immigration, but she demanded what she called Americanization, which she described as uniting immigrants and their descendants around a commitment to democratic ideals and constitutional principles. For immigrants who refused to participate, Jordan supported swift deportation. Today, Jordan's views would be dismissed as racist, but they were unremarkable at the time. In 1994, Bill Clinton awarded Jordan the Presidential Medal of Freedom. As late as 2006, there were still New York Times columnists willing to concede that immigration came with a downside. Quote, immigration reduces the wages of domestic workers who compete with immigrants, economist Paul Krugman wrote that year in the paper, will need to reduce the inflow of low-skilled immigrants. That same year, Hillary Clinton voted in support of a fence on the Mexican border. So did Barack Obama, Chuck Schumer, and 23 other Senate Democrats. But that was the last gasp of a dying elite consensus. Consider two Democratic platforms written just 4 years apart. In the 2000 platform, the Democratic Party was broadly pro-immigration, but still recognized the many downsides of not adequately controlling its flow. Democrats believe in an effective immigration system that balances a strong enforcement of our laws with fair and even-handed treatment of immigrants and their families, the platform said. It boasted that the Clinton administration had drastically improved immigration enforcement and cut down on abuses of the asylum process. Illegal immigration was condemned for taxing government services, harming local communities, and hurting American workers. In places, the 2000 Democratic platform sounded familiar to what Donald Trump would advocate just 15 years later. Quote, "We must punish employers who engage in a pattern and practice of recruiting undocumented workers in order to intimidate and exploit them," it said. "We believe that any increase in H-1B visas must be temporary and must address only genuine shortages of highly skilled workers." The platform vowed to protect American farm workers, not just foreign pickers imported to replace them. In a single presidential cycle, everything changed. In 2004, gone were concerns about protecting U.S. workers, stemming a torrent of illegal border crossings, or punishing employers reliant on illegal workers. Instead, the 2004 Democratic platform called for an amnesty for illegal immigrants and a path to citizenship. Vows to protect the border focused only on keeping out terrorists, drugs, and weapons, not on illegal immigrants themselves. The 2008 platform went even further. Now, not only did the party demand an amnesty for current illegal immigrants, but it also called for an across-the-board hike in immigration visas for both family members and skilled workers. The Democratic Party now endorsed unrestrained mass immigration. Remarkably, after almost 150 years of fighting for tighter labor markets, organized labor went along with most of this. In 2000, the AFL-CIO called for eliminating all sanctions on employers who deliberately hired illegal immigrants. The union also called for a total amnesty on the estimated 6 million illegals already in the country. By 2016, when the Democrats faced off against Donald Trump, there were virtually no immigration skeptics remaining on the left. The same politicians and intellectuals who had once acknowledged a need to enforce the border and protect workers now disavowed their old views and suggested those who still held them were racist. The Democratic Party had given up trying to represent the working class in favor of investors and welfare recipients, and by 2016, illegal immigrants. In the 2016 Democratic platform, the party reframed immigration from a debate about economics to the next frontier in the struggle for civil rights and social justice. Any references to the effect of immigration on American citizens were deleted. According to the Democratic Party, the goal of immigration policy was to ensure the well-being of immigrants. Quote, "The current quota system," the platform explained, "discriminates against certain immigrants, including immigrants of color." It's hard to think of a claim more at odds with numerical reality. In 2016, only about 18% of immigrants to the United States were white. Thanks almost entirely to immigration, the population of the country had gone from 84% white in 1965, when Congress stopped favoring European immigrants, to 62% white in 2015, and the number was dropping every year. There are a lot of things you could call American immigration law, but the product of white racism isn't one of them. 20 years after Bill Clinton told Americans they had the right to be upset about illegal immigration, his wife scolded the country for enforcing border controls. The 2016 platform demanded that all 11 million illegal immigrants living in the United States be, quote, "incorporated completely into our society through legal processes that give meaning to our national motto, E Pluribus Unum." It was a stunning shift. It was now Democratic Party orthodoxy to give illegal immigrants, all of whom enter the country in defiance of U.S. law, the right to vote. If you had a problem with that, you were betraying the fundamental promise of our country. The change was purely a product of political calculation. Democrats understood that the overwhelming majority of immigrant voters vote Democrat. Surveys showed they were right. Ironically, the more fully Democrats embraced open borders, the closer they came to where the leaders of the Republican Party had long been. Paul Ryan was elected Speaker of the House in the fall of 2015, At about the same time, Trump began his run for president. Once Trump won, it was Ryan's job to translate the new president's campaign promises into workable legislation. Unfortunately for Trump and the voters who supported him, Ryan had no intention of doing that. On immigration, Ryan agreed with the Democrats. Ryan spent the early 1990s in Washington working for former Buffalo Congressman Jack Kemp, one of the most aggressively pro-immigration Republicans in the House. During his time in Kemp's office, Ryan watched the voters of California approve Proposition 187, which barred illegal aliens from receiving state welfare benefits. Ryan was appalled. He and Kemp led Republican opposition to the law. When National Review attacked Kemp for this, Ryan authored a 4,000-word rebuttal. In 1996, Congress debated a bipartisan proposal to significantly curb immigration. By this point, Ryan was an aide to Representative Sam Brownback of Kansas, and he worked overtime to kill the bill. Ryan authored a series of Dear Colleague letters that successfully frightened Republicans into neutering the legislation. 2 years later, Ryan himself was elected to the House. Republican voters became steadily more suspicious of mass immigration during the George W. Bush years, and Ryan at times pretended to agree with them. But it was never a comfortable pose. In 2013, Ryan made an appearance alongside Democrat Luis Gutierrez, probably the most consistent advocate for open borders in Washington, and argued that without high levels of immigration, the rule of law would vanish from America. Quote, "We need to let legal immigrants come here legally," Ryan said. "We can't have a system where we pay homage and adherence to the rule of law if we don't have an open system where people can come here in search of their American dream, where the work that won't be done by people who are already here can be filled by the people who want to come here and do those jobs." In 2015, Ryan said it would be wrong for the United States to take any effort to curb Muslim immigration into the United States because, quote, "that's not who we are." He did not elaborate. After the 2016 election, Ryan did his best to portray himself as an immigration hawk aligned with Trump. He publicly committed to funding a border wall. His staff even produced a video backed with techno music that showed Ryan flying over the border. Message, we're going to secure this thing. He didn't mean it. During the first year of the administration, Ryan achieved his primary goal, a massive corporate tax cut. After that, he seemed to lose interest in borders. In March 2018, Ryan produced a $1.3 trillion spending bill designed to keep the federal government funded and open. More clearly than any video Ryan's staff could shoot, the bill reflected elite Republican views on immigration. Ryan's bill actively restricted the hiring of additional immigration and customs enforcement agents for immigration enforcement. It capped the number of illegal aliens ICE could detain at any one time. It ostensibly allocated $1.6 billion for border security, but the money was explicitly prohibited from being spent on any sort of border wall. The bill did pay for border security, just not in America. Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, and Tunisia all received American tax dollars to deal with their immigration problems. Also included was $10 million to hire female law enforcement officers in Afghanistan, $10 million for disadvantaged students in Egypt, and $12 million to boost the military capacity of Vietnam. China, whose economy is now larger than America's, received $15 million in development aid to promote yak herding in Tibet. Also, Congress gave itself a pay raise. The message could not have been clearer. Republicans in Congress don't care about the territorial integrity of the country they run. Democratic leaders share this view. Hundreds of U.S. municipalities run by Democrats have declared themselves sanctuary cities, barring police from cooperating in any way with federal authorities in enforcing immigration statutes, even against immigrants caught breaking U.S. law. The Attorney General of California announced it is now illegal for private citizens in the state to assist federal immigration authorities in any way. Violators will be prosecuted. In Oregon, a county judge allowed an illegal immigrant caught driving under the influence to leave the courthouse via her personal chambers so that he could evade ICE agents. An investigation later cleared the judge of wrongdoing on the grounds that she didn't know the man was an illegal immigrant, even though she knew he was attempting to avoid immigration authorities. The changes in elite consensus have been so swift that some longtime politicians have struggled to keep up. In 2015, Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders sat for a largely friendly interview with the publication Vox. Vox editor Ezra Klein suggested that if Sanders wanted to curb global poverty, he should endorse unlimited migration to the United States. Sanders already supported amnesty, sanctuary cities, and continued mass immigration, but this was too much even for him. Sanders responded that open borders would, quote, make everyone in America poorer by driving down wages and taxing social welfare systems, all in the interest of pleasing business owners. For this, Sanders was denounced as a bigot who didn't understand basic economics. Bernie Sanders' fear of immigrant labor is ugly and wrong-headed, announced a headline on Vox. In the spring of 2017, the New York Times ran a story about a town in northwest Iowa called Storm Lake. Tyson Foods operated slaughterhouses and meatpacking plants in Storm Lake, and over the years, thousands of workers from Asia and Latin America have moved there to work in them. Not surprisingly, the flood of cheap labor destroyed the local labor union and depressed wages. The Times interviewed one Tyson employee whose hourly wage had remained at $16 an hour for 37 years. What's striking is how the Times interpreted all of this. 20 years before, the story might have been framed as a victory of management over labor. The Times presented it as a win for progress and diversity. Quote, while more than 88% of the state's population is non-Hispanic white, less than half of Storm Lake's is. Walk through the halls of the public schools, and you can hear as many as 18 languages. Mass immigration, reporter Patricia Cohen concluded, had kept the Iowa meatpacking town, quote, alive and growing. Third world immigration saves another American town. Media coverage has been remarkably consistent in the way it presents the abrupt demographic change wrought by immigration. A 2018 story in National Geographic about Hazleton, Pennsylvania, is typical of the genre. In the year 2000, the story explained, Hazleton was 95% white and less than 5% Hispanic. Just 16 years later, 52% of Hazleton residents were Hispanic. Less than half spoke English at home. People who grew up there didn't recognize the city. They didn't hate immigrants. Most Americans don't. But they were bewildered. National Geographic's verdict? Hazleton was another former coal mining town slipping into decline until a wave of Latinos arrived. In Storm Lake, mass immigration had a dramatic effect on violent crime rates, which are 56% higher than in the rest of the state. The New York Times story downplayed that fact, along with the sagging performance of the local schools. The villain of the piece was Storm Lake's anti-immigration congressman, Steve King, whom the paper dismissed as a racist for opposing, quote, cultural diversity. The same story, written using the same set of facts, could have been a PR disaster for Tyson Foods. A multinational corporation brings in cheap labor to undercut collective bargaining. The union fails. Profits soar while wages fall. Workers don't make enough to live, so public services take up the slack. Taxpayers wind up involuntarily subsidizing corporate profits. Tyson's shareholders get richer while everyone else suffers. Newspapers used to write stories like that back before American elites decided that criticizing immigration was worse than hurting workers. Now complaints about demographic change, when they're even reported, are always dismissed as the products of irrational racial fear, white anxiety, suburban racism. This is unfair, but it's also a smokescreen. In fact, mass immigration tends to affect black neighborhoods most profoundly. Until fairly recently, Compton, California was the largest black community west of the Mississippi. Today, only a third of Compton's population is black. The rest is Hispanic. Unless you happen to drive through, you're unlikely to know that. Demographic change in Compton is the subject of relatively few news stories. One place notably unaffected by demographic change is any neighborhood policymakers happen to live in. The people making immigration policy tend not to be affected by it. Los Angeles County, for example, is now overwhelmingly Hispanic. Upper-income Malibu, meanwhile, is still 87% white. New York is a diverse city, but former Mayor Michael Bloomberg's zip code isn't. His neighborhood is 82% white and less than 5% Hispanic. It's still 1985, where Mike Bloomberg lives, and will likely always be. Barack Obama's new zip code in Washington is less than 8% Hispanic. The suburbs across the river in Virginia become more Spanish-speaking every year. Obama approves of that. He sees it as a sign of progress. He doesn't want to live near it. Diversity for thee, but not for me. The more abstract our elite's commitment to diversity becomes, the more deeply it is cherished and defended. Diversity matters more than anything. When the realities of mass immigration conflict with other elite concerns, preserving the environment, for example, elites choose immigration. Consider the case of John Tanton. Tanton is a retired physician from Michigan and a lifelong progressive. He helped to found local chapters of both the Sierra Club and Planned Parenthood, and in general supported the agenda of the Democratic Party. That began to change in 1965 when Congress rewrote immigration law. As millions and then tens of millions of immigrants entered the United States, Tanton started to worry about the effect